so appalled.
So totally fed up.
So glad to have my grievance aired.
Hello, this is Margaret Howard. After a couple of weeks with my feet up, I'm all set for another bout of letterboxing. Whilst I was away, Malcolm Billings did a splendid job tackling the backlog of letters, but he did leave one or two things behind, including a 7-page epistle from Paul Welsh in the Sudan. He begins his tirade with an assault on Gloria Hunniford, but let's join him on page 2, by which time he's really got into his stride.
I was so appalled to hear some weeks ago on Letterbox one of the drama producers apologising in such a despicable way for broadcasting plays of a mind-stretching character. The listener who had written in was upset that she didn't have a nice comedy to listen to whilst making mince pies. For your information, not all those who listen to your drama are middle-aged housewives.
Take Charles Jones, for instance.
Denmark. Dear World Service, lately on Letterbox, some Philistine attacked the play Caritas. Even worse, someone from your drama department apologised for scheduling too many serious plays near one another. No apologies needed. Caritas was one of the best radio plays I've ever heard. It was honest and beautiful. It was damn good. Most of your plays I only listen to for 10 minutes because they are so light and bright, irrelevant, just not good enough.
Not all those who listen to your drama are middle-aged housewives living in some expatriate cloud cuckoo land who can't bear to have any stimulating drama broadcast because it might infringe upon their self-constructed, bland, static, perfectly nice world of some home-from-home blighty. Moving toward what is, I suppose, the service which the World Service is reputed for, news, I've come to the conclusion that the old idea of creating balance by virtue of straight reporting and by virtue of third-party commentary just does not achieve its purpose anymore.
Mr. Welsh takes an example from 24 Hours.
A rabid anti-Sandinistan official in an American human rights department was allowed to rant on for a good minute with no balance provided, owing to the interviewer's inability to be as forceful in his questions as the official. This was no fault of the reporter. The sheer fanaticism of the human rights official overwhelmed the poor man. So how can one maintain balance? I believe that the answer lies in allowing those political figures who are available to make personal defences of their policies to argue against each other. If you had opted for letting someone with comparable credentials to those of the human rights official, such as a spokesman from the American Council on Hemispheric Affairs, give his opinion, balance would have been achieved.
Should each controversial issue really become a matter for debate?
Hilversum, the Netherlands. I am torn as to whether I should praise or decry the current series Matter for Debate. The quality of last week's debate on the SDI project was superb, with not only much humour, perhaps to help deal with the monstrosity of the project, but also it was a serious examination of the Star Wars project by two highly competent and knowledgeable people with a perceptive audience. But this week's debate...
He refers to the discussion on the government's attitude to racial equality.
I don't think one can seriously call it a debate. It sounded more like silly politicians on both sides who want to discredit the opposing party. Sadly, I think they spent 45 minutes without addressing the issue before them. I don't think the World Service should censor such debates, but it does seem futile to spend 45 minutes of airtime on such sterile argument. Yours, Eric Beauchemin.
Well, both 24 Hours and Matter for Debate are produced by our Current Affairs Department. And I'm delighted to welcome the head of our Current Affairs World Service, Elizabeth Smith. Nice to have you here again. Now, what about this matter for debate with silly politicians on both sides trying to discredit one another? Is that how it was?
Well, it was a bit. In fact, it got so lively there with everybody shouting at once that it sounded almost like the House of Commons at its worst. But racial questions are things that people feel very strongly about, and I don't think one can do anything about that. You know, if these occasions take off and people become very excited, well, that's how it is in the real world, and it rather relates to the comments that were made about drama getting too bland. When people feel very deeply about a subject, they do sometimes all talk at once, and, you know, so be it.
But is it a good way of striving for the BBC concept of balance?
Well, it's one way, but it's not the only way. In a debate, as you know, we set up opposing views and it's all very formal and so on. But in our other programmes, we have a variety of techniques that we use. One of them is to have a figure, say, as in a commentary, who can pull together a number of different strands and indicate that there are factors here and factors there, and then may end up giving some of his own opinion as well. Or we can interview spokespersons of particular organisations or politicians, and in 24 hours, a lot of the problems are in fact logistical. The producer comes in, say, for the 1309 edition at 8 in the morning, and has that next edition on the air at 1309, 5 hours later. So sometimes it's not possible to get the various participating politicians all together in the studio at the right time or on a line, wherever they are. So then you may have to either use a person with an overview, or you may have to interview one side of the case, and then in the subsequent or a subsequent edition, you interview somebody with the other side of the case. So you have to use a variety of techniques, and often your choice is made on logistical grounds rather than any kind of grand theory.
So there are occasions when, as in the interview about the anti-Sandinista official, there's one person ranting on with one point of view, and you have to wait for the balance in a further programme.
It can happen, yes.
But do you feel a commitment that if you express one point of view at one time, you must at some stage contribute another point of view which will give the balance?
Yes, we do try very hard. And where we get into particular difficulties are in cases where there aren't just two points of view on a subject, but maybe 5 or 15. And there we very often have to turn to, say, an academic or a journalist who can summarise the whole range of views for us.
Now, some more specific complaints.
We've reached page 5 of Paul Welsh's letter.
Why is it that the world news is followed by 24 hours without a change in format?
That looks like another question for you coming up, Elizabeth.
What I'm referring to is the repetition of the news headlines. What we hear is the news headlines, then the news, then to end the world news, the news headlines, followed by the news headlines to begin 24 hours, then at the end, the news headlines. Thus we hear the news headlines 4 times in half an hour is boring.
Well, what do you feel about that? 4 lots of headlines in half an hour. It does seem quite a lot.
Yes, it does. And in fact, this is something we're actively working on at the moment. As you know, we have recently dropped the signature tune of 24 hours, and we're trying to make it a more integrated programme with the news. But there are limits to how far we can do this. And the main limit is that some radio stations around the world rebroadcast the news. And they take it as a complete unit, and then they stop broadcasting it and go on to their own programmes. So if they didn't have the news with a clearly identifiable end, saying that is the end of the news from London, then they would find it very difficult to rebroadcast the news. So it's not possible fully to integrate 24 hours and the news into one programme. But what we are trying to do is to get into our first item much quicker, because in fact the content of 24 hours is actually quite different from the bulletin. The bulletin tells you what has just happened. The 24 hours area is why it happened, what may happen next, this kind of thing. So our indications of what subjects we're going to be talking about should be phrased in those terms. And so really we are working hard on avoiding this repetition, and I think this correspondent has a jolly good point.
So in fact the third set of headlines that you have are by way of a menu for what's going to be in 24 hours, and they're not news headlines at all.
They shouldn't be news headlines at all, that's correct.
So you in fact have 3 lots of news headlines, and you're going to stick with that, are you?
Well, yes, we'll have to stick with that, because the very closing headlines at the end of the half hour are very useful for people who've tuned in late, so those would have to stay.
Thank you, Elizabeth Smith.
Then there's the music you play. Don't you think this sort of Rule Britannia stuff is just a little out of date? Say 30 years? Also, the chimes of Big Ben. Are they really necessary? I think we would have to be mawkishly sentimental to want to hear them every quarter of an hour. Your whole approach needs revising.
Believe it or not, world service evolves continually. But the best of intentions cause some people distress.
Kikuyu Kenya, dear Margaret, I've just listened to the Tuesday 1830 GMT edition of Nature Notebook, and was horrified to hear that this edition is now being dropped. This news has sent me diving for London Calling, where I was mortified to see that you're also taking away the 1840 Farming World. 10 minutes a week dedicated to the enormous topic of wildlife and conservation was miserly enough, but now I'm to be deprived even of that. More alarming is the removal of the Farming World. For those of us living in East Africa, the alternative transmissions fall either during the working day or the middle of the night. Africa in particular needs all the help it can get to boost its agricultural output. I'm sure I'm not alone in protesting against these changes. Yours, hopefully, Keith Soames.
Nature Notebook and the Farming World have been moved as part of several changes in our schedules, designed to make room for our new-look half-hour programme, Development. We think that should be of particular interest to listeners in Africa, and so the idea was to find a convenient time to let you hear it. Nevertheless, Mr. Soames, your comments don't fall on deaf ears. The powers that be have taken note of your objections.
Port Said, Egypt. Dear Miss Howard, The Pleasures Yours was one of my favourite programmes. I never requested anything, finding it pleasant to listen to a choice of usually agreeable classical music. Gradually, the list of names and dedications grew and grew. But what made me say, oh no, is the in memory of dedication which has been introduced lately. No, not that, please. Music is for the pleasure of those who hear it. And if, on listening, memories are brought back, to each his own. Let those memories be personal. Yours truly, Ellie Donato.
Listeners to The Pleasures Yours can choose music for whatever reasons they wish. But Mrs. Donato is not the only person to be worried about lists of dedications. Someone has written directly to Gordon Clyde. This was how he reacted in last week's programme.
One of our listeners, a Mr. Smith from Denmark, has written to say he's become an ex-listener. He got fed up with too many dedications on the programme, not enough music. Well, now, admittedly, we do try and have our cake and eat it by fitting in as many letters and requests as we can. After all, it's your programme, and if you take the trouble to write in answer to our invitation, we should at least try and acknowledge your interest. But I can see Mr. Smith's point. After all, yours may be only one of literally hundreds of names we give a mention to, and perhaps you're bored by hearing other people's names mentioned and would rather get more music to the square inch, well, square minute. On the other hand, if Mr. Smith could see some of the letters we get from listeners thanking us for putting them in touch with long-lost friends or relatives, or just for allowing them to share a musical moment or two with someone special, well, he might have second thoughts. Anyway, it's your thoughts I'm interested in, so if you've got any comments on that point, do let me have them, and we'll see what the general feeling is.
Gordon Clyde.
On the positive side...
Oh, yes. On the sixth page of his letter, Mr. Welsh in Sudan allows a brief ray of light to shine through the gloom.
On the positive side, About Britain, Letter from America and Meridian reflect a more up-to-date approach. But the programmes are outweighed by the ones like the feature Once Upon a Time. It was yet more meaningless, time-filling chit-chat, a real lack of originality, the sort of programme to fill in time whilst one is making mince pies. Yours faithfully, Paul Welsh.
I really must bring to the defence of the mince pie makers of the world, of whom I am one. A good mince pie is a fine thing indeed, and their makers, ladies or gentlemen, should not be scorned.
Minna, Nigeria. Dear Letterbox, if the BBC must have a Sassenach present letter from Scotland, and if that Sassenach feels she must inform the world of the strange ways of the Scots on such occasions as Burns Night and Hogmanay, then please let her get her facts right.
Namely?
The haggis would be carried on a trencher or an ashet at an informal Burns supper. A quaich is a two-handled drinking cup.
Cheers, Mrs. Dunn.
The description of black bun made it sound like a revolting gobstopper, whereas it's a truly delicious, extremely rich fruit cake held together by thin layers of pastry. Yours sincerely, Isabel Dunn.
As delectable as world service, it seems.
Anderson, USA. BBC broadcasts are fast becoming my daily bread. I am so well nourished, thanks to your wonderful diet. Anthony Koo.
We'll be back next week with some more comments on the World Service menu. Bye for now.